Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 130. It's Monday, September 6th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, I want to do something a little different this week. I want to start with the local COVID-19 update for Lucas County because I want to do a case study on the Toledo-Lucas County Library, which has fallen short of doing mask mandates for its patrons, and I want to talk about that a bit. So I want to provide some context. So let's talk about what's happening locally with COVID-19. Well, the Lucas County average daily number of cases over the last 7 days has moved up to 170 per day. That's a 30% increase over last week. Yikes. And our weekly rate is 242 per 100,000 people. And that I reference because Governor DeWine said that he was going to remove mask mandates when we got down below 50. And we're at 242. So we're almost five times higher than that. So where's the mask mandate, Governor? Oh, by the way, that's Lucas County's rate, which is quite a bit lower than the state rate. And the governor makes mask mandates for the state. Every single county, all 88 counties in Ohio, are high transmission for COVID. The last one fell, poor little Ashtabula County up in the northeast corner. So join the club. At least we have some unanimity with high transmission across the state in every single county. Well, and testing positivity rates are going up. The proportion of people that are testing positive who get tested moved up to 12.6% from 11.3% in Lucas County. Testing volumes went up about 16% last week. And the test positivity rate went up in Ohio from 10.9% to 12.1%. Nice steady increase here, and we're getting in dangerous territory where we're it looks like we're probably going to get as high as we've ever gotten with test positivity rates. Not good. Okay, it looks like it seems they're making a break in nursing homes here as cases just about doubled to 32 active cases from 17 in the prior week. That's 15 residents now in long-term care facilities in Lucas County that have an active COVID-19 case. And 17 staff. Of course, it's the staff that generally bring it in. So, but that's typical of the epidemic so far, is about an equal number of residents and staff getting infected. Fortunately, more residents are vaccinated than staff, but the fact that a large number of staff aren't vaccinated is cause for concern. Okay, well, we have some new data going back to what we were reporting last year. Schools are starting up. And in Lucas County schools, just getting rolling here, we've had, in the last week, 32 staff identified as infected and 120 students. I could only find 1 week that had a higher number of students last year. So it looks like we're off to a roaring start. And only about 1 in 7 school-age Ohioans are fully vaccinated. Of course, many more teachers are because Ohio made a specific effort to vaccinate teachers. Okay, well, Lucas County Schools moving to higher education. UT, University of Toledo, identified 16 cases last week. although 12 of those cases were identified through random surveillance testing, which was 0.7% of the people that they tested randomly. So basically what this means is that 12 of the 16 cases would not have been identified if people were required to seek testing themselves. You could have asymptomatic testing, or people don't want to seek testing based on whatever symptoms they have. So that's 3/4 of those identified. Now, of course, UT, probably because it's associated with a medical college, perhaps, is mandating vaccinations for all its staff and students. And they're going to require proof by November 15th, or those folks in the UT community would be subjected to weekly testing in lieu of being vaccinated. Okay, so we're off to a roaring start. Well, hospitalizations are rising steadily in both Lucas County and Ohio. New hospital admissions in Lucas County were up 39% in the last week. Looks like that's going to be a trend here, folks. Deaths nationally, we've hit over 1,500 deaths a day. And this, unfortunately, is rising much faster than cases, which have seemed to slow down rising nationally as we've kind of peaked out in some of the southern states and some of the western states, and it's moving into other areas, such as Ohio. Well, the interesting thing about the 1,500-plus deaths per day is that in order to get to the leading cause of death in this country, you have to get just under 2,000 deaths per day. That would beat out heart disease and beat out cancer. So we're getting close, and it looks like the trend looks like we're going to exceed that mark. Yikes. Who would have thought 3 or 4 months ago that COVID-19 would once again be the leading cause of death in the United States? But it looks like it's going to happen in the coming weeks. Okay, well, of course, the best protection is being fully vaccinated. We've reached 53% of the U.S. population fully vaccinated. In Ohio, that's only 48.5%. In Lucas County, is slightly lower at 47.5%. And Lucas County is only going about 0.5% of their population being vaccinated per week. So this 0.5% a week, even if we continue that for the next 4 months to the end of the year, we would still have less than 2/3 of our population vaccinated, and that would be well into the flu season. So folks, time for universal masking. Time to mask up, because we are not going to get there in the short term by vaccination, it looks like. Okay, well, with the local report as context, I'd like to switch to a case study now. In my continuing coverage of how fragmented and devolved decision-making has stymied our public health response to COVID-19. So we're going to talk about the Toledo Lucas County Library as a case study. The county library has mandated masks for staff, but not patrons. So the first point here, basically, perhaps the largest point, is that fragmented and devolved decision-making sucks, as each entity must independently take on accountability for a common good. And they must face the highly seductive temptation of avoiding costs to one's own entity, even at the robbing of greater costs from the common good. Fragmented accountability often leads to the tragedy of the commons. The tragedy of the commons is a situation in which individual users who have open access to a resource unhampered by shared social structures or formal rules that govern access and use act independently according to their own self-interest and, contrary to the common good of all users, cause depletion of the resource through their uncoordinated actions. That's from Wikipedia, by the way. In this case, the resource is community health that requires communal action to maintain. If individual entities refuse to do their part, community health is disproportionately harmed relative to the cost declined by any given individual entity. This is why we benefit from communal standards, or in legal parlance, regulations. Okay, the need for universal masking is a scientific reality based on collective actions producing an outcome greater than the sum of its parts. Individual behaviors are not just additive in some directly proportional way, And there's a couple things to understand why that's true with masking. First, one infected individual can infect many others. Secondly, those least likely to wear masks are more likely to get infected and to be infected. They are more likely to be unvaccinated, plus they are more likely to be in social networks at higher risk for infection at home and work. Thirdly, masks work best preventing infected individuals from aerosolizing virus into the air, which can build up within enclosed spaces across great distances. Masks work less well protecting uninfected people from breathing in virus particles. While these benefits are additive, the more layers of protection the better, the most important intervention is assuring potentially infected individuals are masked. In communities with high transmission rates, that would be all of Ohio, by the way, this signifies universal masking in indoor public spaces as highly cost-effective in preventing transmission. And as an added bonus, it is important to notice that greater exposure leads to more severe illness. In other words, the bigger the initial dose of virus you get, it can not only just lead to infection, but it can lead to more severe illness. So in other words, the viral transmission, it's not like pregnancy where either you're pregnant or you're not. You can get just enough virus to get infected, and that will result likely in a less severe course of illness than if you get a huge dose. So this is important for mask wearing for both the people that are infected and not spewing it all over into shared air spaces, and also the layer of protection that people who aren't infected are wearing a mask, which can prevent some of the intake of the viral particles. And if they were to get enough to get infected, they would get a smaller load, which hopefully would reduce the severity of the course of disease. So let's get back to the Toledo Lucas County Library. They have mandated masks for staff, but not patrons, which of course are the overwhelming majority of people in libraries and the overwhelming majority of people who might be potentially infected. The Toledo Lucas County Health Department recommends everyone, both fully vaccinated and unvaccinated, wear a mask in the following situations: in public indoor settings in areas with substantial or high transmission. That's all of us in Lucas County, my friends. And the Toledo Lucas County Library and all of its branches are public indoor settings in an area with substantial or high transmission. Okay, well, I've tried to communicate with the Toledo Lucas County Library's director, but I have to say he gets an F in communication. It might be worthy noting that the Toledo Lucas County Library's director has a degree in communication, but he did not respond to my media inquiry to report on their policies, or in this case, the lack thereof. Nor did the library have signage up. That's my local branch. I checked a week ago and I checked today. Not even a mask suggestion or reminder. Nothing. So much for communication about the importance of living in a pandemic and protecting ourselves in enclosed indoor spaces. Nor could I find any current COVID-19 policy online. Now, when I searched their website, I did find a webpage entitled Here for You, and under Health and Safety, and the title, Is It Safe to Visit the Library? It says, quote, "We are exceeding all the precautions recommended by the CDC and Toledo Lucas County Health Department to mitigate risks in the library for staff and customers," end of quote. Now, I'm pretty sure this is an archived web page, but the question I ask today is, why can't or should they not implement such a policy now? They did it before. Of course, the state mandated it before, so they had no choice, and the whole question of leadership was taken out of their hands. Okay, well, I just want to back up a little bit and talk about why am I picking the Toledo Lucas County Library as this case study, because it's basically a public or pseudo-public entity. And particularly the library serves a huge number of unvaccinated children and families who have unvaccinated and or high-risk members in their household. The number that they serve is probably second only to schools. If the library needs to look at a peer group to know what to do, they should look at schools. Most Lucas County students have mask requirements in their schools. It's back to school time, and time for our Toledo Lucas County Library to sync up with CDC and Toledo Lucas County Health Department recommendations, as well as community practices in peer institutions. The library is behind the curve and unfortunately is dragging us through this pandemic without adhering to reasonable, highly cost-effective practices. Schools can serve all of their students in conjunction with a mask requirement. So can you, Toledo Lucas County Library. You seem to be able to manage to keep patrons from being too loud. You can manage to keep patrons from a variety of misbehaviors in your buildings. Surely you can maintain a culture that values adhering to mask wearing as a means to keep our community safe. Well, I did find this current policy on the library's website. It says, I quote, "We expect customers to respect the comfort and safety of fellow library customers and staff. If your behavior is making others unsafe or uncomfortable, we'll ask you to stop. Comply with requests from library staff. If you don't, we reserve the right to suspend privileges and or access. Comply with local, state, and federal laws and applicable health and safety regulations as mandated or recommended by local, state, or federal health officials." So, it seems to me that the Toledo Lucas County Library wants to follow its own policies and keep customers or patrons safe, they should require masks indoor, as recommended by the CDC and our local health department. Okay, one last comment. This devolution in decision-making has set up truly weird eddies in our collective reality. We don't seem able to follow science consistently and communally. We have some segments of our society seemingly unconcerned about deadly infectious disease, and other parts of society trying to cope with this by doubling down on what little more they can do. This weirdness is perhaps best illustrated by the inescapable logic of so-called booster shots for the general population, while large swaths of people are not vaccinated at all. A top World Health Organization official said, this is akin to, quote, "handing out extra life jackets to people who already have life jackets, while we're leaving other people to drown." We need simple, collective efforts across the board. That's the only way you can effectively deal with infectious diseases in the community. Come on, Toledo Lucas County Library, do your part. You are listening to 106.1 FM WAKT in Toledo. This is Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, I intend to follow the Toledo Lucas County Library for any updates in their policies, and I will let you know. Okay, well, let's continue with more COVID-19 news. We're going to try to limit this and get some more at the end of the show for non-COVID-19 news. Sorry about that, folks. It's the reality we live in. This from Stat News. The White House wants $65 billion for an Apollo-style pandemic preparedness program. The Biden administration last Friday unveiled a sweeping new biosecurity plan, outlining a $65 billion proposal to remake the nation's pandemic preparedness infrastructure in the wake of COVID-19. The new spending would represent one of the largest investments in public health in American history. During a press briefing, Eric Lander, the White House science advisor, likened the proposal to the Apollo program of the late 1960s. The immense funding boost would target programs aimed at developing and manufacturing vaccines, treatments, and tests more quickly. It would also provide new money for laboratory capacity, viral detection mechanisms, and early warning systems. For the first time in the nation's history, due to these types of advancements in scientific technology, we have the opportunity not just to refill stockpiles, but to transform our capabilities, Lander said. But we really need to start preparing now. The new spending would target a wide array of new pandemic preparedness capabilities. It would include over $24 billion for vaccine infrastructure, with a goal of beginning to manufacture vaccine doses meant to protect against any virus family within 100 days of a pandemic threat first emerging. The plan would include nearly $12 billion to develop and have on hand a range of treatments available for any known virus family, even before a particular pathogen emerges as a pandemic threat. It would also provide $5 billion for diagnostics that the government would aim to make available within weeks of identifying a new biosecurity threat. It's not yet clear how Congress will respond to the Biden administration's sweeping proposal, which expands on a previous request to spend $30 billion over 4 years on improving future pandemic prevention and preparedness. In a subsequent version of the Democrats' budget bill, however, lawmakers included just $5 billion, drawing criticism from many public health experts who said the government was repeating the same mistakes that led to the country's chaotic response to COVID-19. The $65 billion proposal doesn't stop at treatments, tests, and vaccines. It would include $3.1 billion aimed at establishing an early warning system for new disease outbreaks, including systems to sequence pathogens found in wastewater and a reliable clinical surveillance system. Biden also calls for spending to help reduce health inequity, fund lab capacity, and improve public health communication. He also wants to put money toward developing better protective equipment for health workers and create better systems for pathogen protection, like better ventilation systems and surface cleaners. The plan also includes measures to ensure that research and development involving potentially dangerous biological agents is conducted safely and securely by fostering a global research environment that adopts and enforces high standards. The lab safety provisions are a potential nod to the unproven theory that COVID-19 originated from gain-of-function research performed in a Chinese laboratory, a long-running controversy in U.S. and global politics. Well, on that last point, I would say we do not need to determine whether there was anything nefarious happening in a Chinese laboratory in order to work to get the highest standards possible in these labs that study these potentially dangerous viruses. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We don't have to prove that conspiracy in order to be concerned about lab safety. Okay, well, next up from Medical Express, one more thing that is a negative side effect of COVID-19. COVID-19 cited a significant increase in healthcare-associated infections in 2020. After years of steady reductions in healthcare-associated infections, significantly higher rates of 4 out of 6 routinely tracked infections were observed in U.S. hospitals, according to a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention analysis of data from the National Healthcare Safety Network. Increases were attributed to factors related to the COVID-19 pandemic, including more and sicker patients requiring more frequent and longer use of catheters and ventilators, as well as staffing and supply challenges. Major increases were found in 2020 compared to 2019 in 4 serious infection types: central line-associated bloodstream infections, catheter-associated urinary tract infections, ventilator-associated events, and antibiotic-resistant staph infections. The largest increases were bloodstream infections associated with central line catheters that are inserted into large blood vessels to provide medication and other fluids over long periods. Rates of central line infections were 46% higher in the third and fourth quarters of 2020 compared to 2019. With dramatic increases in the frequency and duration of ventilator use, rates of ventilator-associated infections increased by 45% in the fourth quarter of 2020 compared to 2019. The CDC analysis found sharp increases in standardized infection rates, indicating that the increases were not simply a reflection of more devices being used. Okay, well, somewhat better news, this from Science Daily. Evidence mounts that MMR and Tdap vaccines strengthen protection against severe COVID-19. Vaccines are designed to induce a strong and long-lasting immune response to the creation of memory T cells and B cells. The measles, mumps, and rubella, the MMR vaccine, given during early childhood, and the tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis, the Tdap vaccine, given every 10 years, are known to elicit a protective response against the diseases from which the vaccines get their names. But these vaccines may have an unexpected bonus. It's possible that they also elicit cross-reactive memory T cells capable of responding to protein targets called antigens that are present in other microbes that cause diseases, including the viral antigens in SARS-CoV-2. The concept is that pre-existing memory T cells generated by a prior MMR or Tdap vaccination and activated by a SARS-CoV-2 infection give the immune system a head start in responding to SARS-CoV-2, thereby lowering the risk of severe COVID-19. They found that patients who had previously been vaccinated for MMR had a 38% decrease in hospitalization and a 32% decrease in ICU admission and death. Similarly, patients previously vaccinated for Tdap had 23% and 20% decrease rates respectively of these outcomes of hospitalization and death. With regard to COVID-19 vaccines, our findings predict that although MMR and Tdap are not a substitute for COVID-19 vaccines, they may afford greater and more durable protection, possibly against emerging spike variants, than the COVID-19 vaccine alone. And in areas where the COVID-19 vaccines are not available, they could protect infected individuals from developing severe disease. I will just comment with this good news that a lot of anti-vaxxers talk about the fact that, oh, we're getting so many vaccines and it's going to overwhelm the immune system. That in conjunction with, people just get naturally infected with whatever's out there. But this is a good example of by getting vaccines, it actually provides a broad boost to our immune system, and in this case seems to provide at least some protection against severe COVID-19. Very good news. Okay, well, vaccination is a long game, and this next story gets to that. This from Medical Express. HPV vaccination will reduce throat and mouth cancers, but overall impact will take 25 plus years to see, says study. Vaccinations against human papillomavirus, HPV, a major cause of throat and back of mouth cancers, are expected to yield significant reductions in the rates of these cancers in the U.S., but will not do so until 2045, according to a new modeling study from researchers at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. HPV is the most common sexually transmitted infectious virus worldwide. HPV infections are often silent, and while most infections clear, some are chronic and can trigger cancers including mouth and throat, oropharyngeal, and cervical cancer because they disrupt DNA and inhibit tumor suppressor proteins in the cells they infect. Although there is no cure for existing HPV infections, new infections are preventable with vaccines, the first of which entered into use in the U.S. in 2006. In the new study, researchers analyzed national databases on oropharyngeal cancer cases and HPV vaccinations and projected the impact of HPV vaccination on the rates of these cancers in different age groups. They estimated that the oropharyngeal cancer rate would nearly halve between 2018 and 2045 among people ages 36 to 45. However, they also predict that the rate in the overall population would stay about the same from 2018 to 2045 due to still rising rates of these cancers in older people where most of these cancers occur because they're not vaccinated. Oropharyngeal cancer is the most common HPV-related cancer, and according to the Oral Cancer Foundation, there are more than 50,000 new cases of it in the U.S. each year. Alcohol and tobacco are also risk factors, but are seen as increasingly less important than HPV. Vaccination is a powerful medical weapon against this family of viruses, but has one major shortcoming. It can prevent, but not treat. In other words, it does not work against established HPV infections or against cells that have been transformed by HPV and are on their way to forming tumors. Thus, it is recommended chiefly for the young who are not yet exposed to sexually transmitted HPV. Most people who are already adults when HPV vaccination became available have never been vaccinated and thus remain at risk for these cancers. Okay, well, last week I had queued up this article from Scientific American, the FDA should remove its restrictions on the abortion pill, mifepristone. And I didn't get to it because of time constraints, but it might have been good because, of course, last week is when Texas passed its anti-abortion whistleblower law with its vigilante enforcement. And of course, abortion is becoming even more of a critical issue now because of that, and there'll be a lot of probably copycat laws. Although, in some good news, is that the whistleblower site to turn people in has actually been taken down. It was taken down by hacktivists, but part of that hacktivism is not just simply trying to crash the site, but it's actually been holding the Texas Right to Life organization accountable for its practices that violate privacy laws and policies. And even one of the hosts that they moved to, which has been known for hosting kind of sketchy sites, and God knows there's a lot of sketchy sites on the web that aren't taken down, but because this site was specifically violating policies and saying it's collecting anonymous information when in fact it's not, it violated the policies, and first GoDaddy, who hosted it, told them they had 24 hours to move to another one, and then the next one they went to, even that had a problem. So now, today, Monday, after a long end of week and weekend of wrangling with this, they're actually just forwarding the site to another site. So it looks like it may not be possible to even do what they're trying to do because of this whole cascade of other laws. Just shows how ridiculous this law has been. But thank God we have other laws that relate to this for the nefarious types of things they're trying to do. Okay, well, let's get to this article. The FDA should remove the restrictions on the abortion pill mifepristone, from Scientific American. The pandemic has shown us that it's time to change the way we get health care, and that essential health care, including abortion, has always been out of reach for far too many. As we look ahead to the future of care, the science is clear. Medication abortion is safe and effective, and it's past time to remove the restrictions on it. Now, actions from the FDA and new research show us that removing the restrictions on medication abortion care has the potential to expand access for many people who need care. The July 2021 special issue of the journal Contraception focuses on the restrictions on medication abortion mifepristone, including its impacts on safety and efficacy, access to abortion, and burdens on patients and providers. Mifepristone is regulated by a Risk Evaluation and Mitigation Strategy, REMS. REMS programs are rare and intended for drugs with a risk of very serious side effects. The mifepristone Risk Evaluation and Mitigation Strategy includes three elements to assure safe use. Mifepristone must be dispensed from a clinic, medical office, or hospital, not a retail pharmacy. Providers must register as certified prescribers. And patients must sign a patient agreement in addition to standard informed consent forms. Together, these restrictions create a sense that mifepristone is dangerous for patients to use and overly complicated for healthcare providers to offer. Massive quantities of data collected during the first 20 years of mifepristone's use in the U.S. demonstrate that it is highly effective and exceedingly safe. Prior to 2020, opponents of loosening regulations of mifepristone could argue that mifepristone was safe for the nearly 4 million individuals who had used it in the U.S. because of the regulations. However, experience during the COVID-19 pandemic demonstrates that restrictions are not what make mifepristone safe. During much of the pandemic, the in-person dispensing requirement for mifepristone was lifted in order to limit face-to-face contact. This meant that providers could send mifepristone through the mail to their patients following a telehealth evaluation. Patients received the counseling and care they needed. Healthcare providers collected the necessary information to determine if mifepristone was an appropriate option, and both avoided the risk of contracting COVID-19. This change provided an opportunity to study how removing this requirement affected, or did not affect, the safety and efficacy of medication abortion care. Two articles in the Contraception Special Issue describe medication abortion care in the U.S. provided through different protocols, including a telehealth visit followed by mailed medications. Both find that these models of care are safe. Less than 1% of patients experience a serious complication and effective. About 95% had a successful abortion without a follow-up procedure. Studies from the U.K., 52,000 patients in England and Wales, and 660 patients in Scotland, reinforce the provisions of medication abortion via telehealth and mailed medications is safe, effective, and highly acceptable to patients. Taken together, these recent studies reflect findings from the pre-COVID-19 era, reinforcing what we already knew. Mifepristone is safe and effective, regardless of how and where it is dispensed. Medically unnecessary restrictions impact healthcare providers' ability to offer medication abortion care. A survey found that 24% of obstetrician-gynecologists not currently providing medication abortion care would do so if the in-person dispensing requirement were removed, potentially more than doubling the number of providers in the Southeast and Midwest, where abortion access is highly restricted. Many patients would prefer to receive abortion care from their primary care provider with whom they have a long-term relationship, but the REMS stands in the way. Although medication abortion care is well within the scope of primary care, the REMS contributes to stigma and barriers at the individual and institutional level. Logistical challenges presented, including the in-person dispensing requirement and resistance from institutional decision makers, results in barriers for providers and unnecessary burdens for patients. Removing these restrictions, allowing pharmacies dispensing of mifepristone, could help normalize medication abortion care, facilitate provision in primary care, and address disparities in abortion access. Patients' reasons for choosing telemedicine abortion with mailed medications highlight why this option is vitally important. Patients describe the importance of privacy, protection from stigma, avoiding unnecessary contacts, particularly important during COVID, and travel. In an interview study of 45 patients in Hawaii, 13% said they would have had to continue the pregnancy without the telehealth mailed medication option. The ability to receive abortion care through telehealth is extremely important for improving access. Providers can reach geographically distant patients, and one provider can serve an entire state without patients needing to find time, childcare, and funds to travel. With every passing year since the approval of mifepristone in 2000, research documenting its safety and efficacy grows, and each study reinforces and builds upon the last. We have more than enough high-quality data to support reconsidering how mifepristone is regulated and to remove the restrictions. Doing so will not be a panacea for abortion access, given the complex web of abortion restrictions that many states impose, but it's a necessary step towards bringing medication abortion care into line with the science. It's time. Okay, well, following the science and doing the best approved practices is not easy, as this article from Science Daily attests to. Affordable Care Act mandates insurance coverage for recommended dental fluoride varnish application during well child visits to medical providers. Fewer than 5% of well child visits for privately insured young children include a recommended dental fluoride varnish application, despite mandatory insurance coverage for the service, according to a University of Massachusetts study. Fluoride varnish helps reduce tooth decay, which affects nearly 25% of 2 to 5 year olds and more than half of 6 to 8 year olds in the U.S., according to earlier studies. The new research published in JAMA Network Open was the first to assess delivery of this evidence-based service recommended by the U.S. Preventive Task Force and the American Academy of Pediatrics for privately insured children. Previous research showed that fewer than 8% of 1 to 5 year olds covered by Medicaid receive fluoride varnish in medical settings. While Medicaid in most states has paid for fluoride varnish applications for at least a decade, private insurance coverage was mandated in 2015 under the Affordable Care Act, with no cost share for families, explains lead author Kimberly Gessler, associate professor of health policy and management at the UMass School of Public Health and Health Sciences. Most kids are not getting fluoride varnish applications in the medical office, Geisler said. I wasn't surprised due to the low rates we've seen in Medicaid-covered children, but I was disappointed that it isn't higher. Medical providers are not required to do this. It's like a mammogram. It's recommended and it's good and they should do it. And the question we were looking at is, do they do it and how often? The JAMA study is part of a larger project in Massachusetts that will delve into more complex questions, such as why medical providers aren't applying fluoride varnish during well child visits. The preventive treatment is especially critical in light of the statistics that fewer than 1 in 3 children under age 5 have an annual dental visit where the service could also be provided. You know, pediatricians usually do a really good job, and I kind of wonder, does this have to do with all the fluoride conspiracies that are out there? I really wonder. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears here and do a couple articles related to nuclear waste. This from the Japan Times. TEPCO to build undersea tunnel to release Fukushima water offshore. Tokyo Electric Power Company Holdings Incorporated plans to construct an approximately 1 kilometer long undersea tunnel to release treated radioactive water from the crippled Fukushima No. 1 nuclear power plant out to sea, sources close to the matter said last Tuesday. While the level of the radioactive substance tritium that remains in the treated water will be diluted to below regulatory standards, the decision to release it offshore into the Pacific is aimed at preventing reputational damage to local marine products amid an outcry from fishermen. The undersea tunnel will be constructed by hollowing out bedrock on the seabed near the No. 5 reactor at the Fukushima plant. It will stretch 1 kilometer east from the plant out to sea, releasing the water into an area of the ocean where no fishing rights are in place, according to sources. TEPCO plans to dilute the treated water with a large amount of seawater to reduce its tritium concentration to less than 1,500 becquerels per liter. As the seawater within the nuclear plant's port area contains radioactive materials, the water will be taken from outside the port. The operator has also considered directly releasing water from within the plant site to reduce construction work, but the diffusion of tritium remained a key concern. It said it will increase the sampling locations and frequency of tritium concentration measurements in the surrounding area. More than 1 million tons of treated water has accumulated at the complex since a massive earthquake and tsunami triggered a triple meltdown at the Fukushima plant in March 2011. Water pumped into the ruined reactors at the Fukushima plant to cool the melted fuel, mixed with rain and groundwater, which has also been contaminated, is being treated using an advanced liquid processing system. The process removes most radioactive materials, including strontium and cesium, but leaves behind tritium, which is said to pose little health risks in low concentrations. You gotta love it. You think we'd learn this lesson about dilution. You know, back in the 70s and earlier, people thought, oh, the oceans are so big, just throw all your waste in there. What, you know, just be diluted out. And here we go in 2021 doing the same kind of garbage, literally, in this case, nuclear garbage, that just dilute it out and everything will be fine. Oh, man. When will we ever learn? Okay. Well, let's get to the next one. This one in the U.S. This from The Guardian. A combination of failures. Why 3.6 million pounds of nuclear waste is buried on a popular California beach. More than 2 million visitors flock each year to California's San Onofre State Beach, a dreamy slice of coastline just north of San Diego. The beach is popular with surfers, lies across one of the largest Marine Corps bases in the United States, and is a 10,000-year-old sacred Native American site nearby. It even landed a shout-out in the Beach Boys' 1963 classic Surfin' USA. But for all the good vibes and stellar sunsets, beneath the surface hides a potential threat. 3.6 million pounds of nuclear waste from a group of nuclear reactors shut down nearly a decade ago. Decades of political gridlock have left it indefinitely stranded, susceptible to threats including corrosion, earthquakes, and sea level rise. The San Onofre reactors are among dozens across the United States phasing out, but experts say they best represent the uncertain future of nuclear energy. Activists thought they had scored a victory when the reactor shut down, until they learned that the nuclear waste that they produce would remain on site. That wasn't supposed to be the case. Under the U.S. Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1982, the federal government was to move waste into a centralized, remote federal facility starting in 1998. In 2002, George W. Bush approved Yucca Mountain, a site about 100 miles from Las Vegas, as a permanent underground nuclear waste repository. But in 2010, the Obama administration scrapped the controversial plan. Without a government-designated place to store the waste, the California Coastal Commission in 2015 approved the construction of an installation at San Onofre to store it until 2035. Push that old can down the road. In August 2020, workers concluded the multi-year burial process, loading the last of 73 canisters of waste into a concrete enclosure. San Onofre is not the only place where waste is left stranded. As more nuclear sites shut down, communities across the country are stuck with the waste left behind. Spent fuel is stored at 76 reactor sites in 34 states, according to the Department of Energy. Handling those stockpiles has been an afterthought to the NRC, the federal enforcer, said Allison McFarlane, another former commission chair. It was not a big topic at the NRC, unfortunately, McFarlane said. In the nuclear industry in general, the back end of the nuclear cycle gets very little attention, so it just never rises to, oh, this is a very important issue, we should do something. Plenty of risks and not enough oversight. The waste is buried about 100 feet from the shoreline along the I-5 highway, one of the nation's busiest thoroughfares, and not far from a pair of faults that experts say could generate a 7.4 magnitude earthquake. Another potential problem is corrosion. In its 2015 approval, the Coastal Commission noted the site could have a serious impact on the environment down the line, including on coastal access and marine life. The installation would eventually be exposed to coastal flooding and erosion hazards beyond its design capacity, or else would require protection by replacing or expanding the existing Song shoreline armoring, the document said. Concerns have also been raised about government oversight of the site. Just after San Onofre closed, the company began seeking exemptions from the NRC's operating rules for nuclear plants. The utility asked and received permission to loosen rules on site, including those dealing with record keeping, radiological emergency plans for reactors, emergency planning zones, and on-site staffing. San Onofre isn't the only closed reactor to receive exemptions to its operating license. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission's regulations historically focused on operating reactors and assumed that when a reactor shut down, the waste would be removed quickly. It's true that the risk of accidents decreases when a plant isn't operating, said David Lochbaum, former director of the Nuclear Safety Project for the Union of Concerned Scientists. But adapting regulations through exemptions greatly reduces public transparency, he argued. Exemptions are wink-wink, nudge-nudge deals with the NRC, he said. In general, it's not really a great practice, former NRC Chair Jaxo said about the exemptions. If the NRC is regulating by exemption, it means that there's something wrong with the rules. Either the NRC believes the rules are not effective and they're not really useful, or the NRC is not holding the line when the NRC should be holding the line, he said. The problem we have here is that the NRC is simply not doing its job as a regulator. So what it has done is allow the industry to basically determine the conditions under which the material is stored on a temporary basis across the country, echoed retired Rear Admiral Len Herring, who served more than 30 years in the U.S. Navy and was awarded a 2005 Presidential Award for Leadership in Federal Energy Management from President George W. Bush. Meanwhile, at San Onofre, two close calls draw the ire of activists and townspeople. In 2018, workers found a loose piece of equipment in one of the canisters, causing a 10-day work stoppage to ensure the error didn't pose a threat to the public. In a separate incident several months later, a canister filled with radioactive waste became wedged when employees were loading it onto the ground and it dropped nearly 18 feet. The second incident was not made public until a whistleblower brought it up at a community event. After these incidents, the NRC cited the company for failing to ensure equipment was available to protect the canister from a drop and failing to notify the NRC in a timely manner. In a memo, NRC staff told the company it was concerned about apparent weaknesses in managing storage oversight. The company was fined $116,000, but permitted to continue loading casks within 1 year. Casks within 1 year. Another concern is that the CEO of Holtec, the manufacturer of the canisters, told a 2014 community meeting that the canisters are difficult to repair. It's not practical to repair a canister if it was damaged, Chris Singh said. Singh walked the statement back last September, but questions remain as to what San Onofre would do if a canister did indeed appear damaged. According to a plan the California Coastal Commission approved in July 2020, the company will also inspect two of the 73 buried canisters every 5 years and a test canister every 2.5 years, starting in 2024. But critics say they're not confident the company would self-report given the utility's record. It's a self-reporting industry, the retired admiral said, and they simply can't be trusted. It's worth considering how things fail, though, argued Rod Ewing, nuclear security professor at Stanford University Center for International Security and Cooperation and author of a 2021 report about spent nuclear waste that focuses on San Onofre. The problem with our safety analysis approach is we spend a lot of time proving things are safe, and we don't spend much time imagining how systems will fail, he said. And I think the latter is what's most important.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever. Callus always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, as is customary, I'd like to end the show on a more positive note. So here's an article from Scientific American. Is this food really healthy? New packaging labels would tell you. Today's grocery store aisles are overflowing with healthy, whole grain, and all-natural treats and snacks. But when you take a closer look at the nutrition facts and ingredients, some of these foods are actually packed with sugar, fat, salt, or artificial flavors. To crack down on misleading claims, lawmakers recently introduced legislation called the Food Labeling Modernization Act of 2021, which would require and standardize a front-of-package labeling system that tells consumers if a product is healthy or if it is not. The labeling system would include an easily recognizable symbol that rates food on healthiness. One option is a traffic light icon. The idea might be to make the light red if the food was full of sugars and fats, for example, green if it were low fat and full of vitamins, and yellow if it was in between. Another system suggested in the bill would use stars. Think 5 stars for a fiber-rich, low-calorie granola, and a 1 star from an artificially sweetened and colored cereal. If the product contains lots of saturated or trans fat, sodium, or added sugars, there would be an additional warning on the label. The bill includes further requirements for claims of certain ingredients. Any food item with the term whole grain on its packaging would have to clarify the actual percentage of whole grain content. Products that said they contained fruits or vegetables, even those that just had images of an apple or tomato on their label, would have to clarify how much of these ingredients they included. These labels, the bill stipulates, would be standardized in how they looked and where they were located on a food's package, bag, or box. Supermarket shoppers are no doubt familiar with back-of-package nutrition fact labels, those black and white boxes that declare how many calories, grams of sugar or milligrams of cholesterol, and quantities of other nutrients that are contained within one serving. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration required and standardized those labels in 1990 to better inform the public, but they do not always drive consumers to pick one food over another, said Jason Lusk, an agricultural economist at Purdue University. A notification on the front can be more obvious and persuasive. Research does suggest that front-of-pack labels have more impact on consumer choice than standard nutrition fact labels, he said. But there are pros and cons to such markers, Lusk explains. For one, some research shows that people do not always respond to them predictably. You might see that a product has low sodium, but that might signal to people, this tastes bad, and dissuade them from purchasing it, he says. Another con is the difficulty in creating a one-size-fits-all definition. People have very nuanced and conflicting perspectives on what healthy means. Plus, there is limited real estate on the front of a packaged food, Lusk points out, so exactly how the labels would look and fit might impact their efficacy. The meaning of symbols might also get lost in a supermarket, which is often a chaotic and overstimulating place even for the savviest, most nutrition-conscious consumer, said David Just, an agricultural economist at Cornell University. Shoppers are just looking for the gist of whether something is healthy or unhealthy, he says. Busy, multitasking people do not always have the time or bandwidth to read and consider complicated labels on the front of every product they throw in their cart. Most of the decision-making happens on a knee-jerk level, he explains. That said, Just thinks the new bill does address a real problem and could perhaps have a positive influence. Some countries in Europe have put spotlight labels on foods to grade them on their healthiness, similar to the new bill's proposal, he says. We're not the only country dealing with this, Just says. In 2016, Chile passed a law mandating front-of-package warning labels. Although that requirement's direct effects on metrics such as obesity are not yet clear, some companies did reformulate their products, taking sugar, salt, or saturated fats out of their recipes to avoid warning labels. Just and Lusk both point to successful efforts within independent grocery stores to implement spotlight or star systems that grade foods on nutritional value. When we've seen simple systems like this put in place, it generally causes a pretty positive impact on shoppers who are just a little less engaged in nutrition. Okay, well, let us consider that an effort informed consent on what we eat. More information is good. And quickly consumable information, even better. Although, of course, on this show, you'll get plenty of long read information. And I'm ending the show here with a half a dozen bonus articles this week, which you can read online. Of course, the articles that I covered are also, the links are online if you want to go and read them in full or just review them. Okay, the bonus articles this week. Number one, the debate over COVID-19 vaccine boosters, what to call them and whether they're needed. Two, Biden pledged to, quote, follow the science, but experts say he's sometimes fallen short. Three, U.S. forces are leaving a toxic environmental legacy in Afghanistan. Four, feds responding to reports of oil and chemical spills after Ida. Five, high incarceration rates fuel COVID-19 spread and undermines U.S. public safety, study finds. And finally, six, leaded gasoline is finally gone, but its toxic legacy lingers. The lead is still there in the soil. You can read these and other articles at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-